Welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and the classicist is Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ilya Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, I want to talk today about a big piece that you had in the most recent print edition of National Review, which ran under the title Trump's Reactive Engagement. And what you've done here is an analysis of foreign policy making in the Trump administration, as well as a kind of, I guess you'd call it like a global threat matrix. So before we even get into some of the specific hotspots, let's talk about something this piece goes into in some detail, which is the philosophical underpinnings of the Trump foreign policy, which you locate in the national security strategy that the administration released a few years ago. In that document, it is dubbed strategic realism, but the shorthand that you will often hear for it is something along the lines of a new Jacksonianism. But what that phrase actually means seems to vary quite a bit by the speaker, particularly when it comes to the question of how much a neo-Jacksonianism implies more isolationist tendencies than may have been present in the last couple of administrations. So how do you read the underlying foreign policy principles of this administration and what that Jacksonianism means?
Well, I think it means that given the limited resources of the United States 75 years after the Cold War, and given the dismal record that we've had in the Middle East, translating tactical victories on the battleground into strategic resolution in our favor, especially in a cost-to-benefit analysis, that expeditionary preemptive wars are not really in our interest. But we understand there's interest in the Middle East because their oil, while it doesn't affect us as it used to, affects our allies. So what we're doing is we're saying when a problem gets out of control, we might intervene if other allies want us to intervene, but we're going to do it on different terms. We're not going to get engaged in the streets of Baghdad or Basra. We're not going to fight counterterrorism. We're not going to nation build. We're going to bomb the, as Trump said, the SH blank blank out of ISIS. Or we're going to take out an Iranian general like Soleimani, who's key to a lot of the terrorism in the region, but we're not going to go into Iran itself. And what it's predicated on, I think, is that we're going to be no better friend and no worse enemy. And by that means we have limited resources, so we're going to try to help our NATO allies if they're willing to pay their proverbial fair share, and then put countries that are democratic and close to the United States, like Japan, South Korea, Australia, Taiwan, maybe the Philippines, we're going to protect their interests there under the American nuclear umbrella. So I think the idea is that we're going to hoard our resources and then focus them with much more clarity, but we're not going to try to change the Arab world, or we're not going to try to change Africa or Latin America as we have in the past, because the argument that Trump was made, it fell inordinately on the interior of the country. Those were the people who end up fighting it. Those were the people who saw the economy stalled for them under globalization. And those were the people who were hurt by illegal immigration. So a better way of defining American security would be closed borders, more American industry within the United States, and a Jacksonian don't tread on me foreign policy.
So let's walk through some of the specific countries that you talk about in the piece. And I want to start with China. And Victor, the president's defenders will say, we finally have someone who gets it. This is a sea change. We haven't had a president go head on at China this way before. Donald Trump is just dropping all the illusions and recognizing this for the threat that it is. And on the other side, the critics, interestingly, the critics have sort of changed their tune over the course of the administration, because early on, there was a lot of hand-wringing about upending the trade relationship. Now there seems to be a lot more acceptance that something is fundamentally broken in the relationship between the two countries. So the critique has shifted more to, well, what good has any of this done? If anything, the hostility is more out in the open. We haven't come to a resolution on trade. The Chinese are gobbling up Hong Kong as we speak. How do you judge the administration's strategy on China thus far?
You know, I try to tune out all of the rhetoric, pro and con, and I just look at the data and I say to myself, what is our relationship and the world's relationship to China now versus, say, in 2017? And I think most people believed in 2017, given the prior 16 years, that the policy had failed to indulge China on trade and mercantile issues. And it was just a matter of time before they were going to enjoy a natural hegemony. And they probably were not going to democratize as had been sold to us by our elites, that the more wealth they accumulated and the more westernized they became, the more constitutional and consensual they would become, and they would become as well ideal world citizens. So we're over that now. The COVID-19 brand, the COVID-19 virus really destroyed the Chinese brand. But we're in a weird situation now where, after being contrite, they look at what that virus did to the United States and they said, wow, the virus caused their first mass quarantine. It destroyed their booming economy. It sent the country, they see it as, into almost a civil war. They're in election year and they're at each other's throats in the way they've never been before. This might be something we want to investigate. The Wuhan wet market exegesis is over with. Nobody believes it anymore. At best, they believe the virus escaped from the lab, but nobody tells us why it was there and what they were doing with it, whether we're having enhanced capabilities for quote-unquote peaceful purposes or medicinal purposes. But it doesn't really matter, because I think now the problem is that China is no longer contrite, and they're basically saying, who knows? One of these things could get away anytime, anywhere, to any people, and wouldn't be our fault. So they really haven't paid a price yet for this. And it's very important that our allies and everybody start decoupling from the Chinese economy, if only to show them that these are the wages of what they did. And I think that's happening. So by and large, things are much better vis-a-vis China than they were 3 years ago. I will say that people like David Goldman have warned us that we are not creating enough STEM engineering talent here in the United States. We don't have enough research and development investments. Our universities are therapeutic rather than top-notch as the way that they used to be. Computer science, electronics, physics, math tend to be politicized finally, that the cultural evolution is starting to affect them. So we have to be very careful how we decouple. We have to do it, as I said earlier, with six guns drawn as we back out of the saloon.
Let's move on to Iran. Of all these foreign policy areas that we're going to talk about, this is probably the one that breaks down the most along a conventional left-right axis domestically, in that you've got the Trump administration operating on the conviction that the Obama administration was deluding itself, that the Iran nuclear deal was worthless, in fact, actively counterproductive, that the Iranians had to be met with force. And that treaty, along with the withdrawal from that treaty, along with the killing of General Soleimani, has left people on the left saying, well, we're just destabilizing things. President's kicking sand in Iran's face, and it's just making it more likely that there will be a conflict at some point. Give us your grade on the conduct towards Iran.
Before Trump came into power, we knew what the American-Iranian policy was, because Barack Obama had disengaged essentially from Israel, at least psychologically he had. He'd been very hard on regimes in Egypt and Jordan, the Gulf states, and he'd been lax or actually appeasing or enabling the Iranian theocracy, especially with the 2015 Iran deal. And the idea, I think, was that we were going to watch Shia Persian interest balance off Sunni Arab interest, and then that creative tension, and then balance out Israel as well, then people would look to us to adjudicate in Obama's rhetoric and cosmopolitanism and global citizen and all that stuff was going to heighten his importance. That didn't work because Iran looks at all magnanimity as weakness to be exploited. And so what we're doing now is, after the Soleimani assassination, getting out of the Iran deal and really pumping a lot of oil and holding Iran to account. And I think they know that if they were to do something stupid, like attack an American ship, they would lose a power plant or a base or something. I think it's a very different policy. We are tilting now toward Israel, toward moderate Arab regimes. And the Europeans may say they're not, but they're following along, and so are our allies in Asia. And the people, and this is, it's bringing clarity, the people who are on the Iran side are essentially three countries, Russia, China, and North Korea, and they're providing the expertise. But it's a much better policy, and I think it reflects the interest of the United States much better than the Obama protocols.
I want to talk about Russia, because if the countries that you mention in this piece, it may be the one that's the hardest for a layperson to parse, because so much of the focus on Russia the last few years has been tied up in the collusion arguments that the press doesn't spend very much time on Russia as geopolitical adversary. I mean, the criticism we've heard, of course, for a while has been that the president's too soft on Russia, that he's too solicitous of Vladimir Putin. What does the relationship with Russia look like to you?
Well, it's at an impasse, and Trump's tried to say something clumsily expressed, perhaps, about Russia paying bounties for enemies and that we did the same thing. It was true, but it comes off at a bad time. I think what Trump is trying to say is that Obama talked tough, but he appeased Russia, and that he was the author of Reset, and Reset lost Crimea. It lost Eastern Ukraine. It put Putin into Syria and adjudicating the Middle East. And it was an ungodly disaster, and it emboldened Russian hackers to interfere with elections that transcended the 2016 presidential election. So what he's trying to say is, look, we upped the sanctions on Russia. We increased oil production by 3 million barrels a year. We crashed the world price, the only source of Russian revenue. We sold lethal arms to Ukraine, which Obama would never do. We've ended any idea of reset. We have even killed Russian mercenaries in the Middle East. We've been very, very tough. But that toughness should allow me to go back to this model that we always did, that we triangulated with China against Russia and with Russia against China. So I think Trump feels that if he could develop a working relationship with this dictatorship in Russia, murderous as it is, I don't think in its totality, it's quite as murderous as the Chinese, because it doesn't have the capabilities, although it does have 7,000 deliverable nuclear weapons. But I think if he had that tool, then he could work with Putin on matters such as radical Islam, terrorism, and checking Chinese aggression. And so I think that's a frustration. He understands that if he mentions the word Russia, even though the entire Russian hoax is history, and that nobody believes Christopher Steele, nobody believes the dossier, everybody believes that the FBI, CIA, and DOJ was weaponizing and will be held to account, at least most of them will be. Nonetheless, the media fixate on Russia in a way that makes it almost impossible for him to have a Kissinger-like workable relationship.
The last hotspot in the piece is North Korea, and this is the one where the president has probably taken the most flack from his fellow Republicans. And conservatives have carped for years about the futility of negotiations with Pyongyang and how the U.S. always winds up giving a lot more away than it gets in return. You can see a lot of this, for instance, in John Bolton's book. And that criticism ratcheted up in some quarters when President Trump had the in-person meeting with Kim Jong-un. This is one that has slipped out the front pages a little bit of late, but how well are we handling North Korea right now?
I think given our deterioration with our relations with China, they are openly supplying North Korea with enough strategic materials, food, fuel, et cetera, that they can survive the sanctions. But the sanctions are insidiously impoverishing the North Koreans, and that's kind of a misnomer because they're poor to begin with. I don't know how they get any poor. But nonetheless, they're isolated and they're contained, and nobody really is officially, openly, publicly trading with them. And we're going to continue to do that. So anytime you have a standoff like this, there's essential things to learn from history. We have been in this situation before under the Bush administration, the Clinton administration, the Obama administration. And at some critical point, we fold, usually on humanitarian appeal. If Trump doesn't fold, despite stories of North Koreans eating grass, and while we're upping our anti-ballistic missile capability, I think we are, we're going to do, in this standoff, we're going to have the advantage. And we already do, but the key is not to give in, try to tighten up the sanctions, and then make it clear to the North Koreans that we have the technology to render inert their missile system. And then we have to also tell the Chinese that its support for North Korea is part of the bundle that has lost them access to the U.S. market. And I think we can do that.
Final question for you. You talk in this piece about the virtues of President Trump ignoring a lot of the foreign policy establishment shibboleths, whether it's confronting the Chinese or pushing on NATO members to up their defense spending or junking the Iran treaty. As you survey the landscape, are there other ideas out there like that, views that are just accepted as gospel at the State Department or the Council on Foreign Relations or wherever you have, do you think are still in real need of being knocked off their pedestal?
Well, Trump is kind of, he reminds me of St. Augustine's youth when he talked about hanging out with the wreckers. He's done a pretty good wrecking job of pieties and platitudes, because there were certain international groups, the World Health Organization in particular, that was corrupt to the core and probably ended up costing thousands of lives because it was bought and sold by China. So we're over, and that was very good to distance ourselves from these international groups that say they're humanitarian, but in fact, they're anti-American, they're anti-Western, and they're controlled by Chinese money. And everybody said NATO should pay more. I don't know if they're going to, but they're paying more than they did under Obama and Clinton and Bush, both Bushes. And so he got results there. And I think that people realize we don't listen anymore to the International Criminal Court, or we don't listen to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. And so we participate in the UN, but we've never been more suspicious or eager to check the UN's influence. And that's been good. The Chinese policy has been good. So I can't see. I know that everybody says foreign policy is a wreck. And when I hear that, I ask myself, okay, the policy vis-a-vis Iraq was better than now. The policy vis-a-vis Iran was better than now. The policy vis-a-vis Israel was better than now. The Japanese are not our friends now. The Australians are not reaching out to us. They are both doing that. Our policy toward North Korea is worse than it was. Our policy toward Mexico's manipulation of the border to vent this, to export dissidents, to win remission money, and to, I think, destabilize the United States. I think our relation with Mexico is a lot better, especially when they begin to patrol the border. So we can go down the line and we can hear all the bipartisan establishment. They're all angry because Trump was crass and uncouth. But when you look at the actual details, country by country, we're much better off, unless you believe the Council on Foreign Relations, Pentagon, State Department official line that we've done irreparable damage to the tone, the conversation, the affability. But that wasn't getting us anywhere, I don't think. It got us nowhere in the Middle East. It got us nowhere with China. It got us nowhere with Iran. It hurt us with moderate Arab countries. It hurt us with Israel. It hurt us with our allies. It got nowhere with NATO. So I think there's a period in which this disruption brought a lot more results than the sober, judicious status quo. But it made them absolutely furious because If you read foreign policy or foreign relations or the Brookings publications, it's almost monotonous. Every week, somebody tries to find a new vocabulary to outdo a rival commentator by saying Trump is a monster. Trump will destroy the post-war order. Trump did irreparable damage. Will never be. And they not. But when you read the article, there's no article. There's no empirical data. There's no argument that you can find.
You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read all of Victor's work at victorhanson.com, and he's on Twitter at VDHanson. And if you enjoy the show, please rate it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.